Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy. David Hume, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 8.
Hume revolutionized philosophy by adopting a new perspective for understanding ourselves, our relation to the world, and our relation to each other. We can see this new perspective most clearly if we contrast it with the older theoretical perspective that Hume rejects. In the theoretical perspective, human beings are conceived to be egocentric, outside, disengaged observers. As isolated thinking subjects, human beings are thought to have two tasks, a theoretical task and a practical task. The theoretical task is to discover how the world of objects really is. This is how Descartes expresses the theoretical task.
For a long time, I had remarked that it is sometimes requisite in common life to follow opinions which one knows to be most uncertain, exactly as though they were indisputable. But because, in this case, I wish to give myself entirely to the search after truth, I thought that it was necessary for me to take an apparently opposite course, and to reject as absolutely false everything as to which I could imagine the least ground of doubt, in order to see if, afterwards, there remained anything in my belief that was entirely certain.
There's a serious unresolved problem in trying to carry out this theoretical task. The problem is that modern thinkers had come to recognize that the standards of rationality are internal. That is, we invariably must begin with how things appear to us. Descartes' own starting point admits as much. But we can't guarantee that the way things appear to us is the way things really are. Many modern thinkers work to determine whether our internal standards of knowledge can accurately describe an external, objective reality. None succeeded. They didn't succeed because the human being who had to judge the success of the effort was still isolated and trapped within his own world. Thinking human beings also have a second, more practical task. They must interact with the physical world, attempting to control the physical environment and to make it serve human purposes. That's why science and technology have become so important in modern times. Descartes has described why we work so hard to gain technical mastery over the world.
By knowing the force and action of fire, water, air, the stars, the heavens, and all other bodies that surround us, we should be able to utilize them for all the uses to which they are suited, and thus render ourselves masters and possessors of nature.
To deal with this practical task, rationalist philosophers such as Descartes distinguish between body and spirit, between a material world and an immaterial world. Unfortunately, the relationship between the mental and the physical remains unexplained. By separating mind and body in their theories, these philosophers had made it difficult to explain the relationship between mind and body, between thought and action. For rationalists, the practical problem of mastering nature remains a mystery because the very relationship between theory and practice is interpreted as itself being a theoretical problem. What else would we expect from the theoretical perspective? Just as theory hasn't explained how we can know the world, the theoretical perspective hasn't explained how to understand the relationship between thought and action. Because Hume's rationalist predecessors separated the mind from the body, they saw a separation and a conflict between reason and passion. The original theoretical perspective conceived the mind to be disembodied and disengaged. In short, the theoretical perspective led to skepticism about the possibility of human knowledge in general, and it created an insuperable gap between thought and action. In contrast to the rationalist philosophers, Hume's empiricist philosophical predecessors, such as Thomas Hobbes and John Locke, argued that there is no separate mental world. Rather, the mind is just another part of the body, presumably the brain. The irony here is that although they denied a separately existing mind, Hobbes and Locke continued to look at the world from a perspective that assumed the mind could disengage itself. In a sense, they spoke from a perspective whose existence they denied. Because Hobbes and Locke still operated from the theoretical perspective, they interpreted the relationship of thought to action to be just another theoretical problem. They tried to understand their own thought and action as if they were looking at them from the outside. What happens when our own thought and action are viewed as distant objects? Hobbes and Locke interpreted them in the same way they interpreted external physical objects. They assumed that whatever is true of the body in general is therefore supposed to be true of the mind. Since the body was understood to be an object that can be influenced and controlled by other bodies or objects, so the mind too can be influenced or controlled by external objects. The problem with this view is that it's difficult to see how a material being whose activities are caused by external events can be said even to have a practical task. The whole notion that human beings have purposes and that they rationally try to carry out these purposes seems lost once the mind is just another object controlled by outside forces. For Hobbes and Locke, there's no longer an inside force or mental world different from the outside physical world. So control of our actions has to come from outside forces. Hobbes and Locke managed to avoid Descartes' dualism of body and mind, but at the cost of creating even worse problems. By assuming that human beings are isolated and disengaged observers, Hobbes and Locke also faced the problem of explaining how and why people can cooperate in the social and political world. Unfortunately, they couldn't show how the tasks of isolated individuals could be seen in a socially coherent and responsible way. The best they could come up with were either Hobbesian arguments about how isolated individuals cooperate out of self-interest, or the Lockean idea that God guarantees that isolated individuals will be better off cooperating. Hobbes even went so far as to try and derive all social and political obligations from the individual's drive for self-preservation. If this is all we have, then there's a constant, unremitting danger of the social world falling apart. One of Hobbes' supporters, Bernard Mandeville, had argued that there was no moral realm. Mandeville said that benevolence was only a mask for self-interest, that the pursuit of self-interest or vice was socially beneficial. Like Hobbes, Mandeville argued that only the fear of external force keeps human beings at peace. Here again, human beings are understood to be objects, subject to external forces only. Mandeville puts it this way.
No species of animal is, without the curb of government, less capable of agreeing long together in multitudes than that of man.
To sum up, the theoretical perspective separates the mind from the body, our thought from our actions, and this generates three problems. First, it cuts us off from the world. Second, it cuts us off from ourselves. Third, it cuts us off from each other. Against the background of these three unresolved theoretical and practical problems, we can understand Hume's revolution in philosophy. He announces this revolution in the introduction to his treatise of Human Nature.
It is evident that all the sciences have a relation, greater or less, to human nature, and that however wide any of them may seem to run from it, they still return back by one passage or another. Even mathematics, natural philosophy, and natural religion are in some measure dependent on the science of man, since they lie under the cognizance of men and are judged of by their powers and faculties. It is impossible to tell what changes and improvements we might make in the sciences were we thoroughly acquainted with the extent and force of human understanding, and could explain the nature of the ideas we employ and of the operations we perform in our reasonings. We ourselves are not only the beings that reason, but also one of the objects concerning which we reason. In pretending, therefore, to explain the principles of human nature, we, in effect, propose a complete system of the sciences, built on a foundation almost entirely new, and the only one upon which they can stand with any security.
Hume's originality lies in the fact that he was thinking in pragmatic or action-oriented terms. He tested his theories against the standards set by practical requirements.
The most abstract speculations concerning human nature, however cold and unentertaining, become subservient to practical morality, and may render this latter science more correct in its precepts and more persuasive in its exhortations.
Hume proposes to circumvent the three problems of the theoretical perspective. He wants us to adopt a new outlook, where the theoretical perspective assumes that we are all isolated thinking beings. Hume's perspective assumes that we are primarily social and practical.
There are in England, in particular, many honest gentlemen who, being employed in their domestic affairs or amusing themselves in common recreations, have carried their thoughts very little beyond those objects which are every day exposed to their senses. And indeed, of such as these, I pretend not to make philosophers. They do well to keep themselves in their present situation. And instead of refining them into philosophers, I wish rather that we could communicate to our founders of systems a share of this gross earthy mixture.
Hume views human beings fundamentally as agents, as doers, immersed with others in a physical and social world. He sees humanity's primary task as practical, not theoretical.
Man is a reasonable being, but so narrow are the bounds of human understanding that little satisfaction can be hoped for in this particular. Man is a sociable being, no less than a reasonable being. Man is also an active being. It seems, then, that nature has pointed out a mixed kind of life as most suitable to the human race.
Hume's philosophy is not only a radical shift from the rationalist perspective, but it is also an intrinsically social view of human beings. Instead of scrutinizing our thinking process to uncover rational principles that can direct our action, Hume reverses the process. He begins with our practices and our actions. From them, he wants to extract our inherent social norms of behavior. He presumes that an efficient practice always precedes the theory of that practice. Hume attacks rationalism relentlessly. He attacks those who emphasize theory over practical concerns, but he's not attacking reason. Clearly, he has a different idea of what it means to be rational. He persists in reminding the reader that reason alone can't make sense of itself when viewed from the purely theoretical perspective. For Hume, reason can't be understood in theory alone. It must be understood in action. Within our own actions, we can discover principles to guide our future actions.
The end of all moral speculations is to teach us our duty. And by proper representations of the deformity of vice and beauty of virtue, beget correspondent habits, and engage us to avoid the one and embrace the other. But is this ever to be expected from inferences and conclusions of the understanding, which of themselves have no hold of the affections or set in motion the active powers of men? Extinguish all the warm feelings and prepossessions in favor of virtue, and all disgust or aversion to vice. Render men totally indifferent towards these distinctions, and morality is no longer a practical study, nor has any tendency to regulate our lives and actions.
David Hume died in 1776 at age 65. In his lifetime, few philosophers had appreciated his work, and few could stimulate him to even greater heights. But Hume was well-liked by those in the literary world. His French friends called him Le Bon David, and in Scotland he was known as Saint David. Hume died unaware that his philosophy would later influence many thinkers. It would excite the controversy that he'd hoped for but didn't achieve in his lifetime. But there was little disagreement in the affection that Hume's friends had for him. Perhaps his closest friend, the Scottish economist Adam Smith, best captured those sentiments in a letter written upon Hume's death.
Thus died our most excellent and never-to-be-forgotten friend, concerning whose philosophical opinions men will, no doubt, judge variously, everyone approving or condemning them according as they happen to coincide or disagree with his own, but concerning whose character and conduct there can scarce be a difference of opinion. Upon the whole, I have always considered him, both in his lifetime and since his death, as approaching as nearly to the idea of a perfectly wise and virtuous man as perhaps the nature of human frailty will permit.
This concludes Knowledge Products, The Giants of Philosophy. David Hume, narrated by Charlton Heston.